From KCRW in Los Angeles and PRI, Left, Right, and Center presents 1 year later.
1 year later.
Can you believe it's 1 year later?
1 year later.
1 year later.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
Hi, I'm Ruben Navarrete, one of your hosts for the special series 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. It's the Trump era, and we're taking a new approach to political debate. When scaring up the votes to get elected, Donald Trump portrayed immigrants as dangerous and violent criminals. He promised to rein in these bad hombres with a deportation force akin to President Eisenhower's Operation Wetback in 1954. Now deportations are up, even in the interior far away from the border. But a lot of good law-abiding people are being swept up in the process. What's really going on, and is it harming America? We'll look into it. That's coming up on 1 year later after headlines from NPR.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
We're back with 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Ruben Navarrete, syndicated columnist and host of the podcast Navarrete Nation. Immigration enforcement. It's not just happening at the border, but also in the interior, where Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents are racking up deportations, even at the cost of dividing families, destroying lives, and disrupting the workforce. But in the rush to deport, are distinctions being made between the criminals we are told should go and productive folks who maybe should stay? Here's the acting director of ICE, Thomas Holman.
The president's made it clear in executive orders, there's no population off the table. If you're in this country illegally, we're looking for you, and we're going to look to apprehend you. You get your day in court. We're going to try the day in court. And the decision is going home.
Joining me in studio is Grace Meng, senior researcher at the U.S. program at Human Rights Watch. She investigates abuses in the U.S. immigration system, and she's a former immigration lawyer. Hi, Grace. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So the Trump administration seems to be very proud of its deportation and arrest records. I hear about it a lot. But paint a picture for us of the actual impact that all of this is having on the interior of the country, on people's lives, on businesses and communities. What's going on there?
Sure. So as Holman's made very clear, no category of immigrant is exempt from deportation. He has said that every deportable immigrant is a priority. And what we have seen in our research and interviews with people who've been recently deported, we have seen that means many more long-term immigrants, people who've lived in the U.S. for 20, 30 years, people who have U.S. citizen children, spouses, sometimes even parents and siblings, people who've really established lives here, who are valued employees, business owners, are getting deported with no consideration of these family and other ties to the U.S.
Now, immigration officials claim the crackdown is all about public safety, getting rid of bad and dangerous people. Based on your report, we're seeing the arrest and deportation of many immigrants who have strong ties to the U.S., and they have either a minor criminal history or sometimes no criminal history at all. Do I have that right?
Yeah. So ICE's own numbers make clear that there's actually been an almost near tripling of people who have been arrested with no criminal convictions compared to the same time period in 2016.
Let's listen again to Acting ICE Director Thomas Holman.
There's no prerequisite that you commit yet another crime to enforce immigration law. You know, the IRS enforces, you know, tax law. We enforce immigration law. That's our job, and that's what we're going to do. So there's no prerequisite. You have to yet commit another crime for us to pay attention to you.
You see, when he said another crime, that's where it perked up, right? For those of us who follow the immigration debate, when Thomas Holman said another crime, many Americans believe that just being in the country without the proper documents is, in fact, a crime, and that all undocumented immigrants are therefore criminals. But is that true?
That is a really common misconception. So being in the U.S. without status is a civil violation. It is not a crime, and which is why when you get arrested by ICE and you get your day in court, as Holman's put it, you don't get the kind of court hearing that we imagine from what we see on TV or in the movies. You don't get a court-appointed attorney if you can't afford one. You don't get the kind of due process that we expect in a criminal justice system. You get a civil proceeding.
It's also why, when you think about it, that people, when they're apprehended, are deported and not jailed. Because, again, it's a civil violation. It's a good point. Joining us now is Jeremy Redman, a reporter at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, where he covers immigration. Welcome, Jeremy.
Good afternoon.
So, Jeremy, I understand that Atlanta has now become ground zero for the administration's immigration crackdown. Tell us what's going on there with sweeps, raids, deportations.
Yeah, so we're seeing arrests and deportations are up dramatically compared to last fiscal year out of the Atlanta area of operations, which encompasses three states, Georgia, North Carolina, and South Carolina. And that's really sowed a lot of fear and anxiety among immigrant populations in the Atlanta area. And in the reporting we've done here, we've found people that are scrambling to get dual citizenship for their children in case they're deported. They're selling properties. They're actually, you know, they're staying off the road. Some are keeping their kids out of school even. And police have noticed a drop in 911 calls, which is quite alarming to them. So they've been holding community meetings to remind the immigrant populations that they're there to respond to their, you know, complaints, that they need to continue communicating with the police about crime.
Jeremy, I'm so glad you pointed that out, because part of that fear factor in a lot of U.S. cities with immigrants is they don't always get the message that, you know, the police officer, the guy on the beat, is not necessarily working for ICE and as an immigration agent. Do you think that message is getting through to the immigrant population of Atlanta?
It's early. It's unclear. But this is, you know, quite an alarming situation for the local police. The police chief in Doraville, it's a suburb of Atlanta, John King, who happens to be a native of Mexico and speaks Spanish fluently, has had community meetings with immigrant populations, encouraging them to keep the communication lines, open with the police. The fear is that with the enforcement, the ramped up enforcement, that is, of immigration laws, that the folks are be too afraid to communicate with police for fear that they will be detected as being undocumented and that police will turn them over to ICE. A couple pieces of context I think are important to mention in this discussion.
Sure.
Is that in the statistics that we're talking about here, while arrests and deportations are up compared to last year, they're actually below 2013 at the height of the Obama administration's enforcement of immigration laws. And in fact, President Obama drew the derisive nickname Deporter-in-Chief for setting a record for deportation. So ICE is quick to point these statistics out when we talk about this. The other thing that is important to mention is while the ICE is saying, look, you know, we're enforcing normally as we would, we're going after people who are public safety threats, we're going after people who are fugitives from us. The one difference that they've cited in their tactics right now, we've done a ride-along with them, is that normally when they would encounter somebody else as they were seeking a specific target who was undocumented, they might ignore that person. But now they're arresting them and bringing them in. They're calling that collateral arrest. So there are more people getting swept up in these arrests than previously were being arrested.
So, Jeremy, let me ask you about that, because I was struck in researching this topic about the notion of collateral arrests. Now, if I kind of see this both different ways, but if they show up at a site, ICE agents, and somebody is there without documents, are they just supposed, and they, even though they didn't come for that person, are they supposed to leave that person and say, have a nice day and vacate the premises? I think a lot of Americans would expect them to do their job, which is to enforce the law.
Right. And that points to another interesting point is, you know, in talking to these ICE agents as we rode along with them this day, we spent a day or two with them recently in the Atlanta area, and they said, look, you know, this is our job. We've been trained to do this. And they expressed satisfaction that the Trump administration is allowing them more latitude to do the jobs that they've been trained to do. So when previously, under Obama administration restrictions, they were under a lot of constraints. Those constraints have been loosened. And they have more latitude. They're arresting more people that they typically would ignore.
Right. It does seem like under the Obama administration, it was much more of a moving target. And they were trying to have it both ways. They were pretending to be more compassionate than they really were. But the Trump administration just doesn't bother with that. They just come right at it and say it. Now, you said that, and I know in your reporting, you've talked to the head of the local ICE office there in Atlanta. Sean Gallagher is his name. Does he sound a lot like he's on the same page as his boss, Thomas Homan?
Right. I mean, he was really telling the line from the administration when I talked to him. He was he basically made the point when we talked to him about their priorities is if you're here and you're undocumented, you need to be prepared to be arrested and deported. It was very blunt. So it wasn't dissimilar from what we're hearing from Tom Homan.
Now, Grace, I want to go back to you. Your research team at Human Rights Watch interviewed many dozens, in fact, of deportees, as I remember. What did they find in terms of the profile of these deportees? There is this public perception advanced by the administration that they're all dangerous, that they're all criminals. What did you find?
The profile is pretty much what we've seen consistently over the years. I think one thing that I really want to emphasize is that immigrants commit crimes at a lower rate than native-born people. So despite the administration's rhetoric that, you know, there are bad hombres, that there are scary people out there, they're just never going to find that many people who are serious, violent, dangerous criminals. And so what we found were a lot of people who had minor convictions. We had found people who had, you know, maybe a 10-year-old DUI and had lived a pretty quiet life since then. We interviewed one man who was actually an Alcoholics Anonymous leader, someone who was really trying to help people, you know, conquer their alcoholism. And he made a wide U-turn, according to a police officer. Traffic stop then quickly led to deportation and the end of almost 30 years in the U.S.
Now I'd like to bring in Sarah Gonzalo, who's a supervising organizer with something called the New Sanctuary Coalition. It helps immigrants avoid detention and deportation. Welcome, Sarah. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Sarah, starting with Donald Trump's campaign promise to deport only these, quote, bad hombres, the president and his administration have really worked hard to divide the immigrant population into two piles, the dangerous and the desirable. I take it you don't see immigrants in such absolute terms?
No, we don't make distinctions between the good immigrant, bad immigrant. We see everyone as being part of the same group, which is the human race. And so the New Sanctuary Coalition will fight alongside all immigrants despite their criminal history.
Now, in terms of how this is playing in the community, one of the things I was struck by with your coalition is that they do this really important work. They're sort of the eyes and ears. They follow immigrants into hearings and the like and to check-ins with ICE. What difference has that made in terms of the proceedings and how they unfold?
Yeah, so as Grace pointed out before, the immigrant community doesn't have a right to an appointed attorney, and many of our members can't afford to pay for one. So they're facing either immigration judges or ICE officers on their own. And so the accompaniment program, the New Sanctuary Accompaniment Program, pairs immigrants up with U.S. citizens who go to their hearings and their ICE check-ins with them. And not only are they there for support, which is incredibly important, but they also bear witness and can hold the system accountable when judges see a courtroom pack of white U.S. citizens, they take notice. And we have seen sometimes judges give friends, which is the term that we use for our immigrant community, give them more time, up to 2 years, to find an attorney if they hadn't found one. So it does have an effect, especially with judges.
So, Sarah, this deportation juggernaut's been going on in the United States for many years and several administrations now. Did this New Sanctuary Coalition that you're a part of, it's based in New York, was it also active during the Obama administration when, as you well know, somewhere around 3 million people were deported?
Yes. The New Sanctuary Coalition was founded in 2007, and we were doing accompaniment throughout the Obama administration. What has changed for us now is the number of volunteers. So the number of people who are aware of what's happening has increased dramatically. And also, as your other guests have pointed out, the fear is much higher right now. The rhetoric has done its job, and so friends everywhere are really scared. So we are finding more people are asking for our support. So both the number of people seeking help and the number of people willing to fight alongside our friends have increased.
Now I want to go back to Jeremy, if I could. Jeremy, in terms of Atlanta, I understand it's become sort of a model city for what the Trump administration wants to do nationally. And for many people who typically have not thought of Atlanta, Georgia, as an immigrant hub, how did we get here in terms of Atlanta and the changes that have occurred there over the years?
Yeah, so one of the main reasons why we've become such a diverse region is our agricultural industry. This is the largest industry in Georgia. It's over, I believe, $80 billion a year. But also it's a large carpet industry and a large chicken processing industry are here. And so that draws workers, and families establish here, and people are drawn to be to reside near their families. There's also a lot of access to mass transit, affordable housing. We're a major magnet for refugee resettlement here as well. So quite diverse, particularly along the Buford Corridor. This is Buford Highway outside of Atlanta that draws large immigrant communities. So it's natural that you would see perhaps more arrests, deportations through immigration enforcement.
Now, Jeremy, most immigrants who come into Atlanta are Latino. They're coming from Mexico or Central America, and they're coming into an existing black-white paradigm. How has Atlanta welcomed these immigrants? Has there been more of welcoming, more resistance? What have you witnessed?
Well, there's certainly tension here. But I would note that what's quite interesting is we found that our mayor, Kasim Reed, an African-American Democratic mayor, the mayor of Atlanta, has been outspoken in support of immigrants since Trump has been elected. And so that's been interesting to see. At the same time, there's tension around that as well, because the city of Atlanta has a detention center that has an arrangement with ICE where it's holding ICE detainees, and the city receives payment in exchange for holding those detainees. So the mayor, while he's been outspoken in support of immigrants, has come under criticism for that detention arrangement.
Jeremy, I want to thank you for bringing that up. When we come back after a break, we'll be taking a break shortly. I want to talk to you more about this arrangement in Atlanta, where it seems the city has actually been profiting from housing and jailing these illegal immigrant detainees, and how people have raised concerns about that. I want to get back to that after the break. But for now, we're going to have to leave that discussion here for a minute. We're going to take a quick break. We'll continue this discussion about deportations and immigration when we come back. This is 1 year later from KCRW. Welcome back. I'm Ruben Navarrete, and this is 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. We're talking about immigration and deportations with Grace Meng of Human Rights Watch and Jeremy Redman of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Also joining us, Sarah Gozalo, who's a supervising organizer with the New Sanctuary Coalition, which helps immigrants avoid detention and deportation. Welcome back to all my guests. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So, Sarah, I want to ask you, you've been involved with the New Sanctuary Coalition for a while. Have you seen the numbers of volunteers increase? How are your efforts typically received in the community, and also from the immigrants themselves? What do you hear from them?
Yeah, the number of volunteers has increased dramatically. There was a difference the day after the election, to be honest, of how many volunteers all of a sudden were showing up in our office, and we're doing an average of 10 accompaniments a week to 26 Federal Plaza, and I have an average of 5 volunteers per accompaniment. So we have hundreds of volunteers who are helping us. And before that, I can tell you I was doing some of these accompaniments by myself. So that's the difference that the election made. And in terms of the people who are coming, seeking our support, it has also increased, and I think part of it is because of the rhetoric and how much fear there is in our community. And so, you know, it used to be that some people who had ICE check-ins, for instance, it is like being on parole, so you would go once every year, once every 6 months to check in with your ICE officer, and it was routine. Whereas now there is a real fear and a real possibility that you will get detained to be deported. And so people are seeking the support of the community, and the community in New York is responding.
Now, Grace, let me get you to talk, if you could, about the court process for people who are arrested. I understand it's been compared almost to a death penalty case in a traffic court setting. The stakes seem really high. As you've mentioned before, they oftentimes, as defendants, don't have access to legal counsel. Tell us what goes on in those proceedings.
So as a former immigration lawyer, I can say that, you know, in a lot of ways, it feels like a kangaroo court. You won't see government attorneys up against someone who has no attorney, who has a really difficult time understanding what's going on. There are children who don't have attorneys who are facing deportation. And you see people getting ordered deported very quickly. Around the country, it really varies in terms of what kind of judge you have, what kind of reception you'll get to an asylum claim. There are judges who deny 95% of their cases. So it's a really inconsistent system where, and that's if you get a hearing. I mean, there are many people who simply don't even get a hearing. They give up because they've been locked up. They're being told that they'll have to wait months before they get a hearing. There are people who cannot get released on bond while they're awaiting their hearing. And it's going to be incredibly challenging to gather the evidence that you need to fight your case. And this is all within a system that isn't going to adequately weigh things like family ties, community ties, the amount of time you've been in the U.S. That we think is necessary under international human rights law.
Now, Grace, let's follow up on that idea. You know, I always hear from the administration, again, about the serious criminals they're nabbing. Mm-hmm. They talk a lot about MS-13. You know, I wish I had a dollar for every time that Attorney General Jeff Sessions mentioned MS-13, this horrible gang from El Salvador. And they play up this idea of serious criminals, but they don't seem to want to talk about the law-abiding people that they're sweeping up, the people with families, the people with deep roots here. Obviously, they think they'll get more mileage out of the former. But is the message getting through to people, organizers, supporters, regular people, that this picture seems a lot more complicated than the administration is making it appear?
I think anyone who is working with the immigrant community, who knows people who are being arrested, deported, who accompanies, you know, the people that New Sanctuary Coalition is helping, they can see how complicated this picture is. I mean, even people with criminal convictions, the story is not necessarily as black and white as it might appear. You know, I've interviewed people who are being deported because they have a 25-year-old conviction for trying to sell, you know, $5 worth of marijuana, and they're going to end up getting deported permanently, exiled, separated from their families. And we basically have a system that does not take into adequate consideration family unity, the right of children to be raised by their parents, that just does not treat people with the dignity that they deserve as human beings.
Now, Jeremy, I want to go back to you. As a former reporter, one of the things I found interesting about Atlanta is that the city wants to have it both ways when it comes to immigrants. It benefits from the labor, clearly, like the restaurants and hotels. It offers itself as a welcoming place, maybe even a sanctuary for illegal immigrants. But it's also making millions of dollars every year from ICE for housing in its jails illegal immigrants who are detained within the city limits. How do city officials go about squaring that circle?
Yeah, that's a really interesting situation. Last month, we gathered documents that show that the city is collecting $78 a day for every detainee it's holding for ICE in its jail. It's collected about $2.8 million so far through this arrangement. And so critics of the mayor who declared the Atlanta a welcoming city have said, look, this rings hollow, hypocritical for you to speak on behalf of the immigrants and saying you're a welcoming city when your jail is locking them up. The city has an interesting response to that. They said, look, because we have the jail holding ICE detainees, they're getting better care than they would elsewhere. They're closer to their families. They have access to mass transit near the city jail. And that actually is a good point in that the ICE detention centers that are elsewhere in Georgia are hours away. There is one, for example, southwest of Atlanta in Stewart County, an impoverished county near the Alabama border. The Stewart Detention Center there has no hotels around it. It's in a rural, remote area. You have to travel quite a far distance to get down there. Another one is located in Ocilla, in another part of rural Georgia. And there's a third now all the way down by the Florida border, So they're saying, you know, if they're not here, they'd be down there away from their families, attorneys, and so on.
So, Sarah, let me go back to you. I understand that many of the American volunteers who work with your group, the New York-based New Sanctuary Coalition, see themselves as part of the resistance movement to a lot of the Trump enforcement actions. What's that about?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've been hearing that the immigration system is incredibly unjust and racist, and attorneys are a little bit confined within a law that is unjust and racist. And so when you have advocates like the volunteers at the New Sanctuary Coalition, you are working a little bit outside of that confinement and pushing the system in a way to bring awareness of what the system is like, that what we hear from the president and the administration is not the full story. That is much more complicated than that. And just with their presence, their silent presence in a courtroom, they're actually resisting because they're not letting the system do what it's doing in the dark anymore. They're going to be witnesses there, and they're going to have to do whatever it is they're doing with someone watching them. And to me, that is part of a very active on-the-ground resistance and people who give up hours every day to be there in support of a community that has, you know, for a long time have had no support whatsoever.
Now, Sarah, let's get to this notion of the coalition and its impact, the impact it's having, influencing the ICE officers and judges. What have you seen in terms of how they're reacting? Do you see any sort of difference, subtle differences, that maybe they treat the people before them with more respect because you have an observer watching their every move?
Yeah, I think that they do. And also, you know, it's in a way, it's you're reflecting humanity onto these judges, ICE officers. And so when they see there is a community behind someone that they used to see by themselves, it affects them. And I think that's only natural. And also, Grace was talking before about bond hearings. If a judge has to make a decision about whether or not to give someone a bond, and the judge sees that there is a large community supporting the person, they're more likely to give bond because there's community support. And like I said before, there are judges who've given our friends more time to find an attorney just because we had packed the courtroom and the judge said, okay, I see you have the support of the community, so I'm going to give you a chance to find an attorney.
So, Sarah, listening to you, I really applaud what the new Sanctuary Coalition is doing in terms of providing these observers. But what's nagging at me is the following question. I've just got to ask you this. Do you think the United States has a right to determine who comes to this country and also a right to deport people who are here illegally?
Well, I would use the term illegally with caution. To be honest, I believe people who are coming to our borders, for instance, in the South, fleeing terrible conditions, there is no other way for them to ask for asylum than to turn themselves up at the border. There's just no other way. That's the way they're supposed to do it. So calling them illegal, I think, you know, I don't think is 100% accurate. And I do believe this country has been built, part of the population in this country was built out of immigrants who came here because they want a better chance, because they want a better chance for their families. And I think that we need to have those open borders, and there is no reason not to have those open borders. The 11 million undocumented immigrants who are here, and we're functioning. And so I don't know why we have to criminalize people, deport people, like it's been mentioned before, people who've been here for over 30 years, who have U.S. children that are 18 and older, who've been working their whole lives here. I don't think we have a right to deport them personally.
Now, let me bring in Grace. Grace, as an immigration attorney, with that as your background, you know, I've been called many, many names from folks on the right. Many conservatives have all these pet names for me, and they think I'm for an open border. You know, I think that they think most Latinos with an opinion on immigration are for an open border, but I'm not. My question to you is, could we get further in this debate and discussion in terms of real immigration reform, a legal process for people to stay in this country, if there was just some sort of acknowledgement of the fact that we can't have an open border, that people who are here without documents should be, in some cases, deported, particularly criminals? We're trying to negotiate, and it just seems like we're on different planets with the opposition. How do we get through this?
So from an international human rights perspective, I mean, there is no right, you know, Human Rights Watch is not an open borders organization, but we believe that rule of law depends on systems and laws being just. And basically, another giant misconception that I think a lot of Americans have is that people who are here illegally are didn't get their papers because they're lazy or they don't want to spend the money. I mean, they don't realize that for the vast majority, there's literally no realistic way for them to get a green card. And so when we talk about, you know, what we should do, I think we need to recognize that there's an incredible injustice going on, that someone who is married to a U.S. citizen, who is barred, you know, for 10, 20 years from getting a green card, that that's not reflecting other values that we hold dear in this country.
Jeremy, I just want to wrap up by going to you. Have you seen any evidence when you look at the judges, the police, the immigration agents in Atlanta that they are, for instance, the judges maybe approving amnesty applications less often or more of an aggressive crackdown by law enforcement in Atlanta? Do you get a sense that there's much more aggressive approach to immigration of these laws in the Atlanta region?
Well, I can tell you the immigration judges in the Atlanta area of operations are notorious for being quite strict on asylum here. And as far as, you know, what we're hearing from the ICE agents, they're saying that they're doing nothing different than they have in the past, that they're targeting specific individuals, people who have been convicted of crimes, who are fugitives from them. But again, they point out that they have more latitude than they have in the past. So if they're going to encounter somebody else who's undocumented while they're going after that person that they were focusing on, they're going to arrest that person as well.
Yeah. And, you know, also, Jeremy, something you mentioned, it's all about discretion. Law enforcement is all about discretion. You know, I'm the son of a cop. I'm not just the grandson of a Mexican immigrant. I'm also the son of a cop. And all police officers and law enforcement, it's all about having discretion. And just because people are in the country illegally, and this is why I think Thomas Holman doesn't quite get, doesn't mean everybody has to be deported. So it's a balancing act, I think. Do you get a sense, Jeremy, that in Atlanta folks are wrestling with sort of the nuances of the immigration debate, or is it much more black and white, like Sean Gallagher, the Atlanta field officer, seems to suggest?
Well, you know, I can tell you that the ICE officers are human beings, too. And when we rode along with them that day, I can tell you that they expressed sensitivity towards this issue as well. Some of them themselves are immigrants or have relatives who are immigrants. And their position is, look, the point that was made earlier is right. To come here, this notion that you need to get in line and apply for citizenship, a lot of people are misinformed that the legal immigration system is so massively clogged that it takes years and years and years for someone to immigrate here legally to obtain a green card and become a citizen. And if your family is already here, they may be here legally or undocumented. Are you going to wait those many years to reunite with your family? So these ICE officers get it. Their point is they may have come here legally. They may have waited that period of time. They may have gone through all those hoops to come here. They feel that they need to apply the law evenly to everyone.
All right, we'll leave it there. It's been a great discussion. Thank you to all my guests, Grace Meng, Jeremy Redman, Sarah Gonzalo. It's been terrific. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
After a break, our Talk It Out segment, when we continue with 1 year later from KCRW. Hi, I'm Ruben Navarrete, back with 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. This is the part of the show where we talk it out. We talk through the big political stories of the day with two political viewpoints. Since I'm representing the center, we're bringing in Dana Houle, a former Democratic state and congressional campaign manager and a former chief of staff on Capitol Hill. He's representing the left. Hi, Dana. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So our first topic is the tax bill. Now, nearly half of Americans seem to oppose, according to the polls, this GOP tax bill. And more than a majority believe that they will not pay lower taxes as a result of it. Here was Speaker Paul Ryan on Capitol Hill weighing in on the poor polling data.
If you look at the polling that was done in Ronald Reagan's signature 1986 tax reform, something like a month before it passed, 18% of the people polled thought they were going to benefit from it. So this is the nature of the debate on things this big, like tax reform. You've got pundits and spinsters and all of this, you know, spinmeisters out there, you know, confusing the public. And so that's what I think is happening here with tax reform, like you see with any large piece of legislation. What comforts me greatly is the fact that the results are going to produce fantastic results that will improve the lives of hardworking taxpayers in this country.
Now, Dana, why are Republicans so motivated to get this very unpopular bill to the president's desk and get it signed into law? Are they tired of winning?
I think they want to reacquaint themselves with it. I think there are multiple reasons. First of all, many of them believe this. Ideologically, they believe in, you know, cutting the top tax rates and cutting the corporate rates and, you know, that will then lead to economic growth and job growth. So in many cases, they're not doing something that they don't believe in. They do believe in these policies. I think also, though, there is they feel pressure to deliver. There's been this talk for several election cycles now, you know, can Republicans govern? And they didn't have to in the last couple terms of, or, you know, last couple congressional terms of President Obama's term, because the government was split. They didn't have to deliver. Now they do, and they really haven't delivered much. The big thing that obviously they couldn't deliver on was repealing the ACA. And I think then that leads to what are the consequences of that? I mean, I think they believe that there are, you know, perception and political consequences to that, but there are also there are financial consequences, and that, you know, there's been reporting now for months that top donors to Republican committees, to super PACs, to candidates are closing their checkbooks, and they have been sending the message that they're not reopening their checkbooks unless the Republicans deliver on something, and the thing that they most want is the tax bill. So if they don't do this, they somewhat avoid an unpopular bill, but if they don't do it, then they don't have the money they believe they need to defend their seats in 2018.
Right, Dana. Now let's look at the math of this. You think the Republicans are actually going to get the votes to pass this bill? I heard today that Marco Rubio is threatening not to support it without an increase in the child tax credit. How do you think this is going to play out?
Well, you know, Marco Rubio has not really set himself up to be taken credibly on things like this. He has basically folded. But maybe that his awareness of that perception of him, who knows, that might make him resolute this time. You know, it's hard to say because it's unclear that anybody has seen a final version of it yet. I know that Rubio has you know, commented on that, and that there are things about the health implications and the top rates that Susan Collins has issues with. And there's also the issue of whether Senator McCain is going to be there for a vote, even setting aside the whether Doug Jones should be casting the vote for Alabama. Even with Luther Strange still there, they only have a couple of votes that they can give up. And if Senator McCain is ill, as he has been quite a bit recently, that gives them one fewer vote. So, you know, they're in a situation somewhat similar to what Democrats were in 2009, where on paper they have the votes, but Senator Kennedy and Senator Byrd were missing a lot of votes and weren't there every day. And the Republicans have that same issue right now with Senators McCain and Cochran.
Now, President Trump had an event at the White House yesterday where he showcased middle-class families. He said they're going to benefit from the bill. You hear this from Speaker Paul Ryan all the time. What are you hearing in terms of how middle-class families would actually fare under this legislation?
Well, again, nobody has seen the bill, so a lot of this is, you know, the good political and tax reporters are, you know, ferreting out the details from what they can pick up from various sources. It appears from some analysis that, you know, middle earners will probably actually pay more. Certainly all of the any previous iteration of this bill, the scoring and the analysis has shown that the top earners will save a lot. And basically the bottom 60% of earners will end up paying more because of losses of deductions or exemptions and so forth. The latest rumors coming out as of about an hour or two ago are that now to make it to balance it so they can get it through, they would end the cuts for families 1 year early. So, I mean, even now they're admitting, you know, by doing that, that, you know, that they're favoring the corporations and the wealthier people at the expense of, you know, knocking off a year for all the deductions that are supposedly going to help families.
Dana, let's move on to another topic, and that is Speaker Paul Ryan's future and whether his time in Congress might be coming to an end. We heard Ryan speaking to the press about the tax bill at the top of the segment, right after he finished. In fact, Politico broke some news. It's reporting the speaker is looking to retire after the 2018 elections. And in fact, he may even be out of the speaker's chair before that. What do you make of this?
It's an interesting article because it definitely depicts Speaker Ryan in a very sort of flattering way. But when you read through it, the details, it basically is setting up multiple potential scenarios, all of which pretty much end badly for him. Various factions that have been problems for you know, John Boehner And now for Ryan, the Freedom Caucus primarily are always, reportedly scheming to take down Ryan, even if there isn't a clear successor who could get the 218 votes that they'd need to be the speaker. So, you know, there's that. There's discontent from a lot of more sort of process, people with a greater fealty to the process who are upset with what they think is heavy-handed, kind of top-down legislating, or not even really legislating, but just, you know, offering up bills as a binary from the speaker's office. And, you know, there's still the issue of whether this thing even gets through. The article, his confidants apparently are depicting this as, you know, if he gets this done, it's his big achievement, and then that leaves next year to go after, you know, entitlement reform, as they call it, which would, you know, be reconfiguring Social Security and Medicare. That would be deeply unpopular. We saw what happened in 2005 when President Bush tried to do it. Nobody wanted to jump off the cliff with him.
Right.
I don't know how Speaker Ryan would be able to do that if people think that he's either about to be deposed or he'll stick around until the end of 2018, but then he's gone.
Now, Dan, let me ask you this. How does the polling look back home in Wisconsin? We always talk about Washington, but back home in the heartland, Wisconsin, Paul Ryan has a challenger. His name is Randy Bryce. How is Paul Ryan doing in those polls?
Well, that's interesting that this story broke today, and another one, similar story last night, the Huffington Post went over some of the same speculation, that these stories break a couple days after Bryce's campaign released a polling memo from his polling firm, a very good, legitimate Democratic polling firm, that showed the race at 46-40, which you would not expect the Speaker of the House to be that vulnerable, but, you know, Tom Foley lost in Washington, the Speaker of the House, in the 1994 wave. It's certainly plausible that Ryan might be looking at that same possibility, and that might make it easier for him to say goodbye.
Now, I've only got a little over a minute left. I want to get you to answer this question. It was not that long ago that Ryan was thought to be in a safe seat. He's one of the big party stars in the Republican Party. What's going on? Where did this Ryan Express go off the tracks? And, hey, did it have anything to do with a guy named Trump?
I think yes, in the sense that Donald Trump as president means that now the Republicans have to deliver. And, you know, if you pick up any third Paul Krugman article, you will see him railing on about how Paul Ryan is not a serious policy intellectual. And I think that some of that is coming home to roost. They don't have a good platform or program to deliver on. And he has an ungovernable caucus, and they're trying to do things that are unpopular. It all adds up pretty quickly.
I've been joined by Dana Houle, a former Democratic state and congressional campaign manager and a former chief of staff on Capitol Hill. Thanks, Dana.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for today on 1 Year Later. Meet us back here tomorrow for our show on the hit movie Coco and what it's doing for the self-esteem of Latinos. We'll go out with one of my favorites, Will the Wolf Survive by Los Lobos. 1 Year Later is a co-production of KCRW Los Angeles and Public Radio International.
Standing in the pouring rain, all alone in a world that's changed, running scared now, forced to hide, in a land where he once stood with pride. But he'll find his way by the morning light. Sound across the nation, coming from young hearts and minds, better. We'll be right back.
Radio International.